of tefillah. So really, it was something that we all, on behalf of the entire community, thank you for. This was planned a long time in the planning, but the way that it came to fruition and the attendance. If you know you have one good thing and it keeps getting and growing, we know that something is done right. And just one more thing, the smicha guys were here, wonderful guys. So when they first came, they thought, well, we're going to a retirement community? We're going to Century Village? And all of a sudden, they felt the youthful energy that there is in the shul. So Baruch Hashem, it was very nice to see. And so my spiritual odyssey began in Springfield, Massachusetts. I was born in Springfield, Massachusetts. My father was a shliach sent there by the Lubavitcher Rebbe in 1950. I was born after 1950. And I grew up in a home that the entire house was one that was looking at what could we do for the rest of the community. My mother is here, Baruch Hashem. My mother is here.
Like 10 people raising
their hand. Only one person that counted, okay. And so I grew up in an atmosphere that literally every single day was what could we do for the community, who was there for Shabbos, and that kind of atmosphere growing up. As I grew up, that was a goal that I had, that I should be able to follow in the footsteps of my father. And there was something very special about davening that my father had. On Shabbos, my father would daven until 1, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. He got there, he was the first one in shul, and he was learning meticulously. So there came a new recognition of what davening was about. Mincha, a regular mincha. I remember once we had to run to the airport. Oh, we're going to daven mincha first. So I flew through mincha, and my father davened mincha at the same pace that he always did. There was no such thing as a throwaway, if you could use that word, a throwaway davening. It just went and it had to be done in the right way. And it was these kinds of things that really, when I had to make a decision in my life what I was going to do, I think it all starts at home. When what I saw at home, what I saw from my father, what I saw from my mother, and in a Chabad family, how the Rebbe led and the enthusiasm that he gave, and that really pushed to dedicate a life to something that is greater than what you can do as an individual, but rather together with a community.
Okay, good evening everyone. I'm Yaakov Gibber, big fan of Boker Ton Synagogue. Very thankful to Rabbi Edelman and Yom Yisrael of Deerfield Beach and Yeshiva University, and Rabbi Glasser for hosting this evening, my colleague here and dear friend, Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg. It's a tremendous chus and an honor for me to be here tonight with all of you. I look out here on a Wednesday night and look at this crowd and look at the thirst and look at the interest and excitement. It is really a testament and a credit to your community and just the learning and the love and the commitment and growing together and learning together tonight is something that we all share and look very much forward to, and I'm honored to be part of it. So my spiritual journey has been a very profound one. I'm from the Upper West Side of Manhattan, but my formative years, I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, going to public high school. And I had the opportunity to go to Yeshiva University High School for Boys, where I graduated, ultimately to Yeshiva College, Reitz, graduate school. But I can tell you, growing up in a public school, secular environment wasn't one that was ultimately nor naturally conducive for an appreciation for tefillah, for prayer, all that much. But I can tell you that personally, there were really two very exquisite memories and highlights, and I would say a motivators that I think about even ad hominem to this day. The first, was what really put me on my spiritual journey, was my opportunity at age 17 years old to be a counselor in Camp Hask. And when I had the opportunity to, as a bit of a novice, to daven in the minyan with the campers in Camp Hask, and to watch the tefillah that literally emanated from the emek halev, from the depths and the sincerity of their hearts, I was so taken and so moved that I wanted to emulate that. And I wanted to be inspired as they were, and I truly was inspired. And it was life-changing, very riveting, and so super meaningful. That's number one. And after I had the chance to attend Yeshiva HaKotel, the Eretz Yisrael, the old city of Yerushalayim. You know, the memories of davening the Yom Narayim, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Mimul, Mokum HaMikdash, to look outside the windows as Rav Nebensal Shlita, the old city, the Rav of the old city, the Chief Rabbi of the old city, Yaakov Katz, HaKohen, he would daven. And my colleague, Rabbi Josh Flug, who's here tonight, also graduated together from Yeshiva HaKotel. The memories of the Yom Narayim, they have stayed with me, they motivate me, I think about them. Just looking out those windows, seeing Harabayis, Makam, HaMikdash, davening, praying, hoping that Emir Tzashem, the HaMikdash will be rebuilt. But the optics, it was the image and all that, that those two experiences so much, not only inspired me then, but inspired me so much now. So it's a topic that's close to my heart, it's a topic that is close to all of our hearts. And that's really for me how my journey began, and it's how my journey continues with those thoughts.
Good evening. I want to echo the expressions of gratitude, Rabbi Edelman, the Young Israel, for hosting us, and what an honor it is to participate on this panel with dear friends. We are dear friends, and Rabbi Gibber works at Boca Raton Synagogue, I work at Boca Jewish Center, and Young Israel, because the truth is, in many communities, the shuls are polarized. There's a real tug of war and a real sense of competition and tension between them, and I say this not just as lip service or for this evening, but genuinely, we get along, we're colleagues, we're friends, and we support one another. And so we do. We work for our own shuls, but we work for one another's shuls. Most importantly, we work together, we work for Klal Yisrael, and we work for Hashem. So it's really great to be here, to welcome my friend, Rabbi Glasser, who brought the cold weather down with him, and talking to the frigid night for us. 50s tomorrow morning, I heard, so...
I'm leaving.
Everyone, we'll take out your jackets and hugs. Okay. And my Karasatov, I want to express my gratitude to Yeshiva University, which was instrumental in molding and shaping me, not only then, but continues to be a great resource for us until today. A little jealous why Young Israel Deerfield got this great program. How did you get this program? We'll have to follow up with that. But we benefit in so many ways, so many ongoing ways, and please bring back our expression of gratitude for everything. Spiritual journey. So I'm still on mine. I'm still growing up. I'm still on our spiritual journey. We all are. I grew up in Teaneck, New Jersey. I see some familiar faces here. I see many faces who, when I was growing up, would have never believed that I'd be on a panel of rabbis talking about spirituality, but here I am. So I went to amazing schools in Teaneck growing up, and I had wonderful educators, wonderful teachers, a wonderful education. I had incredible parents who continued to be a great source of inspiration to me. But like many of my peers growing up in similar surroundings, similar community, I was gaining a lot of information, going through a lot of motion, but the heart, the essence, the panemius, the drive internally needed to still mature and needed to get there. For me, it happened in 11th grade. We were on a class trip. It's a whole story in its own right. And there was a conversation that happened on the bus on the way back, sort of a confrontation I had with my peers, other students, which was a major awakening for me. And they challenged me. I had challenged them about something that was going on. And they challenged me back and they said, Ephraim, you know, we all pick and choose. We're all hypocrites. You think you're better than us? You don't like the extremes that you're witnessing us picking and choosing right now. But we all pick and choose. And you also skip mincha to play ball in the gym. And you also, whatever the case may be. And I listened to them. And typically we get defensive, and I was that night, but as their words continued to echo and ring in my ears, I thought about what they were saying, and I realized there was truth to it. And I decided to go on a journey to discover, do I believe this, do I not believe this? Is it true or is it not true? Because if it is true, then I have to take it more seriously. If it is true, there's responsibility, and there's accountability. And through a series of wonderful teachers I had and reading that I did, I decided to take it seriously. Why am I telling you this? Because when I decided to take my Judaism and my relationship with Hashem more seriously, it expressed itself, of course, in the observance of Torah and mitzvos, a greater strictness and a vigilance with halacha, but I think it came out most meaningfully in davening, in taking davening more seriously, in trying to see davening not as a burden or responsibility or obligation imposed on me, either by my parents or by school, but seeing it as an opportunity to commune with my Creator, to talk to Hashem, and to a sense listen to Hashem, and to connect with Hashem. Rav Kook writes, and others write, that davening is the great barometer through which we can measure how we're doing spiritually. There's a lot of ways to measure how we're doing. But when our davening is going well, it means that our neshama is doing well. And when we're struggling to connect with our davening, it means our neshama needs a little nourishment and a little nutrition. And so I started to take my davening more seriously, learning about it, getting involved in it. And one of the ways that I grew, and I'll close with this, is at the shul which I grew up in, Yeshur, we had an extraordinary team minion led by a remarkable man that many of you knew, Rabbi David Kamenetsky Zichron LeBracha. And he's a close, dear family friend of my parents, but he became a very close mentor of mine because I took on a role after high school. I went to Kerem Yavne for 2 years. When I came back, I became his assistant in the team minion. And instead of being one of the teens who was being shushed, I became one of the shushes. Although that never was effective, I'm sure we can get to that later tonight. It wasn't then, isn't now. But I learned an enormous amount from him about davening with joy and excitement and love and passion and taking advantage of the opportunity to shape ourselves through it. And that team minion, I'm not sure how the team minion is here at the Israel Tifa, but that team minion, the youth minion, show the youth minion. So that team minion was really instrumental in shaping who I am and still the way I daven until this day, and I'm very grateful for it.
Thank you so much. Okay. We are going to begin tonight's discussion with what is perhaps the most obvious change and shift in all of our lives over the last 20 or 30 years, and that is the rapidly developing nature of technology and how technology has become such a central part of our lives, how it has become so embedded in our daily living in so many different ways, how it has become ubiquitous in the ways in which we interact with each other, in the ways in which we manage our own lives, and of course, spilling over into how it relates to our spiritual lives. So our first question tonight really revolves around how has technology changed the way we relate to spirituality and tefillah in particular? Is technology, by definition, hostile to our spiritual growth in tefillah? Or is there a way to harness dimensions of it so that it can enhance and help us grow in tefillah? Is it just as simple as asking people to turn off cell phones during davening to prevent distraction? Or are there other approaches, are there other dimensions of our interaction with technology that we could view in different ways so that it becomes more part of how we can propel our religious growth forward? Who would like to begin? Rabbi Gibber?
So I'll just begin with a little story that happened about a little over a year ago. I was at a family wedding. And as I was rushing to be sure that I was on time, I was frightened that I would maybe miss mincha at the chazan's tish, so I got the mincha early. So I arrived at the wedding, and I was meandering about during the chazan's tish, and they started davening mincha. And what happened when they started davening mincha, you know, gone are the days when they used to give out the chazan's tish, you know, those little sidurim, pocket sidurim that you have. Like, I have one in my wallet, and it's like very torn and tattered. I'm waiting to get a new one. But gone are the days where they give those out. And everybody, had their iPhones, and everybody was shuckling in front of their iPhone. And one of the waiters, who didn't know me, and I didn't know him, came over to me and tugged on my jacket and said to me, "You see, this is the problem with the world. People are praying to their phones." So lucky was I that I didn't have to explain what shuckling was, but difficult enough was it, obviously, to look and confront what is a scene that perhaps we're all familiar. People are literally imagining what that looks like to somebody who's unfamiliar. You're shuckling and you're praying to a phone. And I think the problem and the challenge of technology today, certainly with everything that's available, you know, on our phones, is something that we're familiar with. Not only is it that it's these small little sidurim that are no longer available in the chazan's dish, and you go to a restaurant and you ask for a bencher, and they don't necessarily always have a bencher, because you can get a bencher on your phone. And you give the bencher to your child to bench after a meal, and like, somehow, I'm not sure how that happened, but all of a sudden they're like playing a video game or maybe responding to an email or doing whatever they're doing, but benching happened, didn't happen, happened fast, didn't it? So there's a great challenge in that and the need, and I think that it isn't presumptuous to say that there's an extraordinary addiction, perhaps even the addiction of our generation, that today you just can't be anywhere without your phone. You have to have it, you know, on the road, when you're driving for some, you have to have it, you know, when you're walking, when you're, you know, now they have these cases that when you're swimming, you can take it in the shower, you can take your phone literally anywhere and everywhere. You know, my kid showed me a comical but terrifyingly sad YouTube video, maybe some of you have seen it, where there was a person who was walking in the mall and she was apparently texting or whatever. She was looking down and she was walking and she plopped right into the waterfall before it. It was, you know, the video surveillance saw her, that she fell right in. It's terrible. People are so distracted. It's everywhere. So much so, a number of years ago, you know, even in our learning, you know, it's so distracting. A number of years ago, I was asked to learn with a kid who was a little bit less interested in learning, and we had a chavrusa together. And we're sitting opposite, it's just me and him in the shul. And I noticed in the middle of our learning, he was like playing on his phone. He was texting on his phone. So I thought I'd be like a cool rabbi. And I obviously was a little frustrated that he was doing that. I pulled out my phone and I texted him. I said, "So, are we learning? Do you want to learn?" He writes me back, "No." So I didn't know what to do after that. But I think the problem, I think it's obvious, and it's no. So the ultimate solution in the ideal situation, obviously, is, you know, to turn off our phones, to put away our phones, to find, you know, the sacred space and the time in tefillah. And it's very hard for all of us. I mean, even as recently as tonight, in Chamayr, you know, I've never committed myself to coming to shul weeknights, not with my phone, even on my person. I try to leave it in my office. When I come home at night, I try to take my phone and park it far away, that it doesn't interfere with my family time, when my children are talking to me, when my wife is interacting with me, when I'm present. The absence presence is to pretend that you're present, but you're really not there. And the tool, the vehicle that happens most of the time is with our phones and with the technology. And so ideally, if we can make sacred, you know, the tefillah by not even bringing these devices into tefillah, I would humbly suggest that even turning them off might not be enough, but not even having them with us, that would be certainly ideal. But maybe that's just wishful thinking. So I'll close this, was my response to this segment, to this question, by just sharing a suggestion facing the inevitable, that maybe it's just too difficult. And I'll just share with you the story of a fellow from my community. We'll call him Beryl. I don't have a Beryl in my shul, so you don't have to wonder that it's really a person. But there is a Beryl who's not a Beryl, and he's in the shul. And he has two things that are most descriptive. Number one is he likes to talk during davening. No. Unconscionable, huh? I can't imagine anything like that here. But he likes to talk during davening, and he has a speedy Shmon Esrei. Not only davenes in Chazar Sashat, that's very slow. It's private Shmon Esrei, it's like speedy Gonzales. Say some of it, skip some of it, could be, should be, might be, very fast. And what do you do when you're finished and the rabbi is still davening? You talk to your neighbor. That's number one. The second thing is that a number of years ago, he began the Sechus Brachos. And every single year, around Rosh Hashanah time, he tells me that he started Brachos a number of years ago and he can never get past chapter one. No kidding, because you're talking all the time. But meanwhile, he wants to learn, and he likes to talk. So I tried to marry those two concepts together. And I said, how about the following idea? And again, I say this, noting that I would say this is the second choice, but nonetheless, it's what we have and what we're dealing with. It's a choice and suggestion that I have found, at least in this case, with our phantom Beryl to work. And that is, I told him that while you're, you know, in davening, you've committed yourself to being in shul for those 45 minutes, let's just say. And you finish your davening quicker than perhaps others. You have your phone, and you're either on your phone, you're scrolling down to and fro, you're distracted, you're talking. Let me introduce you to two unbelievable apps. The first is you could go on Chabad.org app, and you could download all different Jewish texts. You could study the Rambam, you could be Marvin the Sedra, you could say Tehillim, you could read commentary, and look how precious those moments can be used and utilized for good. That's number one. But I introduced it to a second app, which I called the life-saving app, and that's Safaria. Anybody here familiar with Safaria app? If you don't have the Safaria app, not that you should use it necessarily during davening, but definitely should use it at home. It's an unbelievable, you know, wealth of encyclopedia information, Tanakh, Gemara, Ma'amari Chazal, Sfarim, literally on your hand, and there's so many other places and opportunities that you could learn. But why specifically this, what I call life-saving app for him? It's because he was able to download this app, and he was able to open Maseches Brachos, not just in Hebrew, but also in English. And every day, while he finishes his davening early, I see him scrolling down, and he's learning Maseches Brachos. And this morning, he texted me that he finished the third parak of Maseches Brachos during davening, which is unbelievable. And I would say it's incredible usage of his time. So I would just submit and humbly suggest, if possible, to take it and leave it, let's take it and let's leave it, let's park it. Let's make valuable those and cherish those relationships with the beloved and cherished ones in our homes, leaving sacred space for our davening. But if in fact it's difficult to do that, to take advantage of, you know, the unbelievable plethora of online learning that there is and these incredible apps to accomplish and make goals in learning, to find success in such a way, to utilize and maximize that time in the most ideal way.
I also have a funny story, and it may be instructive also, where technology may be inspired us for a moment, but several years ago when cell phones were first coming out, and you could program it to alert you, the notifications could be with a chime or a ding or vibration or a lot of different things. So I remember once davening Shemona Esrei, and someone's cell phone pronounced out loud as we all were davening the silent Shemona Esrei, "Message received." I thought it was only directed to me. I was so excited by Amita, by Shemona Esrei. It's the Valdic, unbelievable, "Message received." I echo everything Rabbi Gipper said. The problem, we don't have to reiterate, we all are familiar with it. The absent presence, the notion that we are addicted. You go to a restaurant and people who are supposedly spending time with each other are, their fingers, their thumbs are texting. You go to a park and parents who are supposedly pushing their child on the swing and so on and so forth. Technology has magnified this problem. It has put this problem on steroids, but it's not a new problem. The notion of disconnecting from the world around us to connect with Hashem is as old as our people itself, it's as old as religion itself. And one of my favorite Divrei Torah to tell is, when Hashem asks Moshe Rabbeinu, come on top of the mountain, I want to give the Ruchos, I want to spend some time with you. Alei Elai Ahara Ve'ayesham, climb on the mountain and be there. And Mefarshim say, why do you have to say Ve'ayesham? If I tell Alei Elai Ahara, if you're climbing on the top of the mountain, where else are you? Obviously, where you are is on top of the mountain. And many explain that Ve'ayesham is God telling Moshe, I know at the base of the mountain there are 2 to 3 million people. You've got phone calls to return, text messages to return, emails to return, Facebook messages, direct messages on Twitter, WhatsApps. Now there's no shortage of ways. Moshe, I know, very noble. You have noble, legitimate, many, 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 many things that are distracting you. But Moshe, God says, when you climb on top of that mountain, hey, Yesha, be there and be with me. Hashem is telling Moshe, way back before the invention of cell phones or technology, even then, anyone who has responsibilities, and rabbis are not alone, professionals, parents, marriage, the sandwich generation, taking care of multiple generations, we have awesome responsibilities and they're distracting, so it's really hard to daven to Hashem. And technology has magnified that problem, but technology did not invent that problem. So what can we do about it? And the one thing I'll suggest, and then move on to Rabbi Edelman or to the next question, is I think the degree to which we can't disconnect when we're outside of shul will predict whether we can disconnect or whether we can connect with Hashem when we're in shul. If throughout the rest of our day and throughout the rest of our lives we have no ability to be present in what we're doing, to be mindful and intentional, and to direct all of ourselves, then why would we think, if when I'm sitting with actual human beings who I can see and hear and touch, and even then I'm not really with them, then why would we even believe that when I walk into a room with Hashem where I can't see him or hear him or smell him or touch him, that I'm going to all of a sudden be able to connect? It's hard enough to talk to Hashem with our full attention. So, to me, it's really all about learning to daven when we're outside of shul. It's going to determine how well we daven when we're inside of shul. And I'll leave you with a challenge and an exercise that I've started doing myself, not as consistently as I originally pledged, but I've tried, and I've tried doing it with a series of friends. We have a WhatsApp group, we try to hold one another accountable for it. And that is to spend 3 minutes, that sounds like nothing, 3 minutes a day, where you turn your phone off or you put it on airplane mode. I don't know if you know, you're allowed to put your phone on airplane mode even when you're on the ground. People don't know that feature in the phone. Turn it off or airplane mode, set the countdown timer to 3 minutes with a chime at the end, and then sit there with your eyes closed doing deep breathing and just being. Thinking, you could think about things you're grateful for, you could think about things you need to do, you could, whatever you want to think about. But 3 minutes in which you've consciously disconnected from technology and consciously you're connecting to your inner self. Because we've learned to be totally uncomfortable with ourselves. Walk into an elevator for half a second, you have to take out the technology in the car, you have to take out the technology in other venues, we have to take out the technology because we have this inability to be by ourselves. So 3 minutes a day. When this group and I first started this, we thought, oh, 10 minutes, such conundrums. 10 minutes a day, 10 minutes is nothing, who's 10 minutes? 1 minute will feel like a lifetime. You'll look at that countdown timer, you'll feel like half the day went by, you'll see it was 30 seconds. That's how disoriented we are to the ability to be alone by ourselves. And I'm challenging you as I continue to challenge myself. Create chaburas, groups, hold one another accountable. Do it together, as with friends, as a couple. 3 minutes where you consciously put the phone on airplane mode, put the timer on, no more, no less. 3 minutes where you're breathing, where you're present, where you're thinking, where you're experiencing life. Because if we can't do that when we're not in shul, there's no way we're going to be able to do it when we're in shul. And if we want to be able to be good davaners in shul, we have to learn how to be able to be with people or by ourselves in conversation with others or with ourselves when we're outside of shul as well.
Rabbi Goldberg, I have a similar story like that that you started off with. I was a few weeks ago in Queens, in New York, at the Oyel of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. There's a whole group of people there. People are davening, some are crying, some are singing. And all of a sudden, a cell phone comes off. So somebody says, "You got your answer fast." Halavai, halavai, that's how it should work. So we have an issue here in our shul, and actually, we did very well. We put up a sign, and it said, if your cell phone goes off during shul, it's going to cost you $5. And Baruch Hashem, we're going to have a kiddush.
My show could have built a building.
Okay, could have built a building. Okay, but there's something that comes with that technology. As was mentioned, it can be a tremendous vehicle and a tool for good use, but it has a downside. And again, it's not the first thing. You know, when radios came out, it was the same problem. When television came out, probably when newspapers came out, people were reading the newspaper and show and things like that. There were tremendous distractions. So every generation has to deal with other issues. But think about it. If you're going to daven with your phone, what kedusha does a phone have? You can take your phone into the bathroom. You have a sitter. You daven from a sitter, you can't take that sitter into the bathroom. It will remind you. If you have nothing else, no other choice, absolutely. But if you're in shul, you should take out your sitter to make sure you're davening. You're davening from that sitter. And you spoke about that we're waiting when the 5 and 6 year old kids come to visit. We send them around to teach people how to put their phones on vibrate. Some people have trouble with that. But again, it's a vehicle that it can be tremendous and it can be used in the best possible way. In the palm of our hand, we have communication to the entire world. And when we hold a sitter, we have communication not just to the world but to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And if we can recognize the power that we have, how we daven, what we say, with the seriousness that we take it with, we'll have the world.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, we're going to move on to our next question. There are synagogues outside of South Florida where people talk in shul. Mostly we talk about people that live in South Florida. Many of us come to shul, we don't see each other as much during the week. Even if we do, we're seeing people after various things have taken place during our week. It is a natural element of Jewish life to converse, to talk, to socialize, to come together. It's part of who we are. How do we create this sacred space, which is a term that a number of our panelists have used? How do we create this sacred space? How do we address the natural socializing dynamic that does evolve in shuls? Is it possible? Should it be a goal to stop all talking in shul? Is there a balance of a shul feeling friendly and open to newcomers, to people who are coming in, versus being a place where people don't feel like they're being disturbed in terms of their own personal tefillah? And also, as Rabbanim, who have certainly played major leadership roles, what have you found to be effective in terms of creating an atmosphere that's positive and that's uplifting and that addresses the issue of conversation in a manner that doesn't infantilize community members, but also does confront what's a very challenging dynamic? So this is our question. If you could address talking in shul, since we're in a shul, we'd like you to talk.
I'll try it first, because we actually currently are in the middle of, have recently launched a campaign regarding this issue. And I hesitate to use the word campaign, because every shul I know that began a campaign that way has among the worst talking in the world right now. As I researched the issue and we wanted to address it, and to be clear, in the defense of my incredible community, we do not have a major talking problem. Relative to a lot of shuls we'll visit, there's not a constant hum, and there's not a free-for-all, and you don't feel like you're in Grand Central Station. But frankly, any talking is too much talking, and we decided that if we strive for excellence in other areas, then the core purpose of a shul is davening, we have to strive for excellence there too. And as I researched the issue, and I won't mention the names of the shuls, but some famously are iconic for how they've addressed the issue of talking, whether it's the contract that people signed in which they pledged and their names were on display in the lobby, whether it's the shuls that they began to recite the incredible Misha Berach and the Tosfos Yontif, and only the people who don't talk are the recipients of that Misha Berach. There's a lot of efforts that have been made, and they have incredible success for an incredibly short-term period of time. And when that wave wears off, and people have what to say, they go back to talking, whether it's weeks or months or a couple of years. So as we sat down, we tried to create a sustainable approach or a solution. And we did a few things, and I'll just try to share them briefly. The first thing we did is we created a committee to work on it. And we decided the committee had to be made up of diverse people. So there's men and women and young and old and people with children in different schools in the community and kind of reflect different segments and demographics of the community. Because the makeup of the committee alone would communicate to the community that this isn't just the issue of, you know, the chamyaks, the frumis, the this, the old, the young, that this is a universal concern, and the diversity of the committee would communicate that. And then we brainstormed, and we thought, what can we do? Now, the beginning of the conversation about talking in shul, I think, has to, Rabbi Glasser, you touched on it in posing the question. Any shul that aspires to have no talking from beginning to end can't have a minyan that lasts for more than half an hour on a Shabbos morning. Because the bottom line is you put people together, many of them don't see each other the entire week, and you spend 2.5 to 3 hours together and don't talk. It's just an unrealistic expectation. And if you set an unrealistic expectation, then by definition, you'll be disappointed. Because we are social beings, it's how we're programmed, and it's a wonderful part of who we are. Shul, after all, is a base kinesis, it's a place for gathering. It's why we're there. And the assumption that everyone comes to shul in order to talk to Hashem is in itself a faulty assumption. I'm not going to be presumptuous to suggest a percentage, but probably a good percentage of people come to shul because that's what their parents did, they're afraid socially not to, they have people they want to see. And davening is actually the last thing on their list. Even if they say the words of davening, it wasn't really what drove them to get out of bed in the morning and be there. So to think for a moment that we're going to have an absolutely quiet atmosphere for 2.5 or 3 hours, it's just an unrealistic expectation we're going to fail. And social is a part of that. The halacha, Krishna, you can answer, you can initiate, kavod, yira. Chazal didn't say, talking, what are you talking about? Pastors, get out, what are you talking? They said there are certain moments, even in davening, where the appropriate thing to do is respond, initiate in different circumstances. So on the one hand, you have to recognize people are social, they're going to talk. Secondly, a shul that aspires to be a warm and welcoming and inviting and place of kirov, of outreach, if you create a police state where if you so much as nod or say good Shabbos to the person next to you, you're going to get dirty looks and get thrown out, what kind of kirov are you going to do? What kind of outreach? Who's going to want to come? Who's going to want to come back to that place? And the people who come for the wrong reasons to socialize, would we prefer that they stay home and never make it to a shul? Does that bode well for the future of the Jewish people? So I think we have to have realistic expectations even before we begin to address the conversation. That's number one. Number two, what we try to do, what we're trying to do right now, therefore, is to say our mission, our goal, is not to create absolute silence from the beginning till the end of davening, but it's to choose segments of davening, both which halacha determines are the most important to have no talking, not that we're conceding it's okay to talk or allowing talking during the rest of davening, as some have pushed back, we're not conceding, but the parts that halacha say are the most important not to talk, and the parts, and here's the twist, what our committee thought, and really it was, for me, a novel idea, was to position the campaign not as about between you and God, bin adam l'makom. There's a whole movement of them, stop talking in shul, and much of their literature, which is wonderful on the website, it's all fantastic, but much of it is about, you know, if you come here to talk, where do you go to talk to Hashem? All these bin adam l'makom emphases, and that's great. But what about the people who aren't even sure there is Hashem, don't feel the presence in his life, don't connect to davening, don't know what it means, and don't get anything out of it? If all you do is appeal to their sense of guilt, you're not going to get anywhere. So we've taken a different point of view, which is not b'nit l'makom, but b'nit l'chaviru. You wouldn't dare in the movie theater or on Broadway or in so many other arenas in life to talk. It's rude, it's discourteous, it's unkind. Well, if you are talking and someone next to you is trying to daven, and we appeal to people that there are people all around you who are davening for illness and for fertility and for a shidduch and for children, grandchildren, the list is endless. For you to distract them is just unkind, simply. So our emphasis has not been bin adam l'makom, but the bin adam l'chaviru component. Don't be obnoxious to people around you. We invite you to walk out. I always say, if you feel compelled to speak and you need to go out to the lobby, no one will judge you. We've actually entertained putting coffee and cake in the lobby. Maybe if we $5 for every time the phone goes off during the week, we'll pay for the coffee and the cake on Shabbos. And we've actually considered, entertained it, putting it in the lobby in order to encourage. If you feel compelled to speak, step out, no one will judge you. But if you stay in here and talk, we're all going to judge you. Because you're unkind. Because you're discourteous. Because you're obnoxious. Because you're mean to the people who are trying to connect through tefillah. So we've identified two parts of davening. From Baruch Hu, for Shacharis, or from Nechamar, from the beginning of Shemona Esrei, through the conclusion of Chazaras Hashatz. That's what we're asking you. When people are davening their own Amida, or when you are done but they're still davening, and that's a prime time to be talking or making Siman on the Sechdus, but when you're done davening and people are still davening, don't talk. Don't talk. So we created bookmarks that we put on every seat that list all the things people around you are davening for, and then says, please don't distract them. Your friends, it says your community needs your help. And the idea again is not bin adam l'makom, bin adam l'chaveiro. And the backside is the Mishadera of Tosfos Yom Tov, and it's a way that if someone comes to speak to you, you could kind of hold the bookmark to show, I'm trying not to talk, I want to be included in this Mishadera and go to the next place. We also are going to be unrolling a pop-up banner like you have out there in the lobby, which on the bima is going to be opened at the beginning of Baruch Hu, through the close of the Chazaras Hashatz, when it will be taken down, opened again for Musaf, till the end of Chazaras Hashatz. Because you gotta mix things up. If you don't mix things up, then people will forget and fall back into their old habits. And the third thing we did, and then I'll hand it over, I'm sorry to be speaking so long with it. But the third thing that we're doing, which may get a lot of eye rolls and cynicism, but came from, if one has ever watched professional golf, you'll see that as the professional golfer is about to take their swing, all through the crowd are people holding up a sign that says, quiet. For the people saying Kaddish, who are in a state of mourning and grieving, there are a few things more unkind, there are a few things more insensitive than someone near them talking while they're saying Kaddish for a loved one. It is very, very painful. Shockingly, those same people, a couple of years after they finish saying Kaddish, forget how painful it was for them when they introduced that pain to others, but they've described it as very, very painful. So we have children at the end of davening, for the Kaddishim at the end of davening, we have all these signs on sticks that say quiet for Kaddish, And children throughout the shul hold up signs in the men's section and the women's section. It says, quiet for Kaddish. And no one's lecturing, nobody's shushing anyone else, but if you're standing near a kid holding that sign, you're not going to start talking, and if you were talking, you're going to stop, as the kid looks at you while they hold the sign and says, quiet for Kaddish. These are the things we're doing today. I don't know how it will last or what we'll need to introduce tomorrow. I think it has to be a sustained effort, but I think the conversation is only successful when we begin at realizing we have to have realistic expectations, we have to try to implement it in incremental ways, and we have to encourage people when they're doing the right thing and give them an outlet to step out and so on and so forth, and realizing that these are basic, a very basic human need.
I don't know about you, but those were some spectacular suggestions that I, and we should all, reflect on and adopt and adapt, and really thank you so much for that very important and very special list of suggestions. I'll just share a couple kind of brief thoughts, kind of what we've done. A number of years ago, I actually gave a drusha that I titled, Learning How to Talk in Shul. Learning how to talk in shul. See, I think part of it, in addition, of course, to the ben adam l'chavero, just basic human decency and common respect for others, your space should be honored as I would want my space to be honored. But I think that there's just very basic things that have to be reminded constantly. You know, there's a very big difference, and I do agree that it's very unrealistic to think for a prolonged period of time you're not going to interact with someone that you haven't seen, someone that you're, you know, shared any close friendship, bond, whatever, shared family relationship you might have with somebody else. But sometimes what happens is there's a big difference between, you know, literally turning your chair and facing the other person and engaging in a prolonged conversation versus just simply coming into shul, wishing a good Shabbos, exchanging basic pleasantries, you know, something very, you know, cordial and respectful, acknowledging somebody being there, inviting somebody that's new, perhaps a new and unfamiliar face, invite them to sit next to you, show them the page, periodically check in with them. That's learning how to talk in an appropriate way. But where it becomes inappropriate is where it becomes prolonged, and you get into not just, you know, the scores, but you get into the box scores, you get into the details, you get into the nuances, and the politics, and the opinions, and the, you know, the replies, and all of the, you know, kind of, even the physical facing of each other. I've seen where people literally turn their chairs, and they're not facing Mizrach, but they're facing each other, their new Mizrach. And just learning how to talk in shul sounds, you know, silly almost, but it really is, to express, you know, being cordial, pleasantries, good Shabbos, nice to see you, I love your tie, what a fabulous dress, it's great to see you, you know, basics. But beyond that, not, that's number one. Number two is that those from my shul who are here tonight can tell you that this past Shabbos, when I noticed that the davening was seemingly, perhaps even more unusually quiet than most weeks, I stopped and I expressed with positivity and gratitude and mindfulness, well, this is how it could be very special. I find that when you, instead of constantly, you know, berating or lecturing and shushing and annoying, but expressing, you know, this is a segment of the davening that this has been great. It was a quiet Shemoneh Esrei, it was a quiet Chazor HaShas. While the laning, we were able to hear every precious word of the Kriyas HaTorah. Kol HaKavod, great job, it's been a great, you know, davening. And when you express that positivity, there's, you know, scores of research, and we can all know and we'll appreciate, you know, the positivity, how much distance and how much we gain from that. And lastly, and I know we've all experienced this, and it goes without saying, but I've instructed, you know, my Gabayim to choose our Chazanim responsibly and carefully and rightfully. And what that means is not just the know-how, but we want to make davening an experience with singing and ruach and energy. And when there's an energy, and when there's songs that are familiar, and when there's a spirit that's tangible and grabbable and meaningful and with positivity, and you learn how to talk to each other without getting into an elongated conversation, I found those three tips to be most helpful, and I've seen significant change.
I
I think the issue of being in shul is a universal issue, and speaking in shul, but you know, there's good news and the bad news. The good news is that we're in shul every day. The bad news is that we're in shul every day. So there's a certain familiarity that we have, and sometimes it does not exactly come into focus. And yes, I will agree with Rabbi Gibber, and I know Rabbi Rakefet was here last year, and he's on Shabbos, and he's looking out at the crowd, and he says, you know, for this size shul, it's actually very quiet. And when you think about it, as Rabbi Goldberg said, the big picture is, yes, I would say most people do come to davening, and I would say davening is actually pretty high up on their list. However, we are there all the time, and we see friends, and in Florida, there's always people coming, and guests coming, and we always have that social side, and we have to control it. But, and also, there's definitely a direct correlation between the volume of the chazan and the volume of the talking. No question. Baruch Hashem, we have a wonderful shul here. Imagine you have a chazan here, and here, all of the walls aren't yet open. And you have somebody sitting way in the back, and they can't even hear the chazan. The chazan, Baruch Hashem, 20 years ago, had a booming voice, but it's not the same as it is today. And I think it has to work with the Gaboyim and the Baal HaTefillah themselves. But I'd just like to share a little story. It was January of 2004. In Springfield, Massachusetts, the three Orthodox shuls, we had a Shabbos together, and the theme was Shabbos. The theme was Shabbos. And I spoke Friday night, and I asked everybody in the audience to please close your eyes. I don't usually do that, but I said, please close your eyes. Everybody closed their eyes. I said, can you imagine the Mashiach has come, and the Red Sox are in the World Series. Remember, I said, this was my first prophecy. Remember, I said, Mashiach has come. And you were able to go and sell two of your cars to buy a box seat for the World Series. Pedro Martinez, Zeicher Livracha, was pitching. And it's the ninth inning, and it's a perfect game. And all of a sudden, you hear rustling next to you in 2004. Some guy's got a newspaper, and he's reading the newspaper. You think, what is the guy out of his mind? He's there, and he's reading the newspaper? So there I spoke in terms of Shabbos. And the question was, can you play basketball on Shabbos? I said, why would anybody want to play basketball on Shabbos? The holiest day of the year, you're in Fenway Park, you're finally there, and the Red Sox are there, and you're going, you're reading the newspaper, you can read it anytime. Why would you think you want to do something like that? That's the same thing when we come to shul. Because we're there every day, we sometimes don't recognize the beauty of the moment. Yes, we are there. We're there with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the speakers throughout the week touched upon this numerous times. And if we would come to the understanding that we have God's ear, you know, we send an email, we let you know that it gets there. We send it to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gets it. And if we could appreciate that, we wouldn't have a problem of talking to Shul, we wouldn't have a problem of anything else that connects to our davening, that connects to our Shabbos. But I actually am very intrigued, Rabbi Goldberg, with your plan, and perhaps we could implement something along those lines as well. But you always have a cynic that says, you know what? In the days of the Taisus Yomtiv, they were also talking. Okay, you know, what does Rabbi Jonathan Sacks say? When God makes a miracle, he changes nature. He never changes human nature. That we have to do ourselves. So hopefully we'll be able to have a great goal.
Thank you so much. Tonight has been such a beautiful combination of theory and ideas and practical guidance, and it's really been amazing, and the audience has been great about not talking. And the only one who has a cell phone out is me, but I'm recording. I just want to make that clear for yutorah.org, which is a better app than Safari.
Not during davening,
correct. Do not listen to yutorah.org during davening. A number of times over this evening, we've mentioned different age groups. We've mentioned children, we've mentioned teens and a teen minion, we've mentioned people as they make their way through their life journey. Our final question for this evening is to reflect a little bit on how does a person's relationship to tefillah change and evolve over the course of their life? You know, very often, let's say in terms of our learning, We learn Sefer Bereishis when we're young kids, and we internalize certain conceptions and ideas and interpretations and understandings, and they kind of crystallize at that very elementary level. And if we don't have the opportunity to then go back and explore those very fundamental ideas later in life from a more sophisticated intellectual disposition, then we remain with that very kind of basic understanding. And sometimes perhaps prayer also, tefillah, is something that we either, you know, learn for the first time when we're children, or for the first time when we are becoming more engaged in observing Jewish life, and so we are really at the outset of our journey. And so how is it that we can work to mature our connection to tefillah as we mature ourselves, and to reflect on that?
I think, Baruch Hashem, we should all feel, no matter what age we are, that we're still growing up, and we are still evolving, and we're all in a position that we can learn more. Because if not, then we're stagnant and we haven't learned anything. Think about when we went to school and we were taught how to daven. That means we were taught how to read, and then gradually we started introducing one tefillah and another tefillah, another tefillah. I remember clearly the first paragraph that I was saying, and I actually understood the words. And it was Baruch She'amar V'Haya Ha'olam. And it was like, wow, I actually say that. I'm speaking about Kodesh Baruch Hu, who spoke, and the world came into being. Now, for some reason, the second paragraph that I connected with was Shema Koleinu in Shemon Esrei. And I remember, like, well, again, Shema Koleinu. The words just move you. So if we have the wherewithal to focus in the davening each and every day, Baruch Hashem, we're different one day from the next, and we should be able to focus on different points. But it's work. It's not simple. Chazal called davening avoda shebeleid. It is, we'll call it nicely, the service of the heart. I would say it's like work. Avoda means work. You have to work at it. Now, you have a job. So how does someone work at a job? Do they do exactly the same thing every day? Even if they are in an assembly line, they don't want to do exactly the same. They would like someday to get promoted. They would like someday to get a raise. But it means each and every day you have to work hard. The fact that you work hard yesterday doesn't mean that today is going to be easy. If you own a business, a wonderful business, you're going to go and put up a sign outside. Why would anybody want to buy from you? Today there's competition online. Why would they buy from you? They could go get online and probably they can get it cheaper. So you have to remake yourself each and every day as you are an Ove. You are a worker that you want to make your business successful, you want to make it attractive, you want it to be something that you are proud of. It is no less in the way that we serve our Kodesh Baruch Hu. That we daven. When we daven as kids, that was wonderful. Great, we daven and we came there, we got candies at the end of davening, it's terrific. Baruch Hashem, we got a little bit older, we're davening, why are we davening? Maybe our kids are watching us. So if our kids are watching us, we're embarrassed for the kids. So then we have to daven. Then we go and we move down to Florida. The kids are up north, the grandchildren are up north. What does that mean? That means if we daven the same way when we're in Florida that we daven when we were in fifth grade, there's something missing. We're not getting the story. We come down to Florida, we have to elevate our status. I mean, there are many people who have come here to our community and they began learning Daf Yomi. They didn't have time when they were up north and they were looking for the spiritual growth that they could have. Some of the Smicha students that were here, three of them asked me the same question. And they said, what is your expectation from your community that they should grow? Interesting question. That they should grow. People come, they move to Florida, Baruch Hashem, they had wonderful story, careers, lives, accomplishments. Then they come to Florida, what do they look forward to? So I said, Baruch Hashem, I can say in my community, I've seen many people actually have done things that they didn't do before. And I gave them one example. It's a simple example, but it is very telling. We were learning the halachas of Chol HaMoed. Halachas of Chol HaMoed. And it says, you should dress like you dress on Yom Tov. Now, it's not my minhag to wear a shrinal and a bekasheh on Shabbos. But there are those who do. In Chol HaMoed, you go to great adventures, and you go onto the boat rides, and hanging there, and the dock, you have a shrinal and bekasheh. You know what? It looks like Yom Tov. There's something to be said. So I said here, you know what people should do? When you come to shul to daven Chol HaMoed in the morning, just wear a jacket. Wear a jacket. You know, it's a little bit different. A little bit different. So the fellow said, really, you did it? I said, you know, there were a couple of people who did it. Not a huge success, but Olam Olam, each person. So there was growth. So if it comes that you come, your respect that you have in shul will grow, that's a tremendous thing. But when it comes to davening, again, it's something we have to work at. Again, the good news is it's every day, the bad news every day. So we have to make sure that the experience is special. There's a part of davening that's called karbonis. Some people say it, some people skip it. Can you imagine? You have an opportunity today to go into the Beis HaMikdash and bring a karbon in the best way possible. In the Shalom Afarim Sefaseinu, our davening takes care of that. That should be, I don't know if the most, but one of the most important parts of davening. We should take our time, we should say each word meticulously, and when we say it, we actually went and we fulfilled bringing the karbon to the Beis HaMikdash. We learned that Zvachim and Menachas, if it's not perfect, it doesn't work. Surely, if a word that we say of karbonis is not perfect, who knows what happened? When we were at school, our teachers would tell us, if you make a bracha, it creates a malach, creates an angel. What happens if you didn't say the bracha so well? It's a handicapped malach. It's in a wheelchair. Like, what's going on? No, you have to say it the right way. And if we would appreciate that, if we would appreciate that, there would be no way we would even think that we should do it anything different. And Baruch Hashem, as we get older, we should be more mature, we have more word to daven for. Shulchan Aruch says that Shleach Tzibur Rashan Yom Kippur should have been married and have children, because he knows what it means to daven. You have not just yourself, it's not a selfish exercise, but it's more. And hopefully when we will be able to recognize those things, it will make our davening in every stage of our life much better. Because of course, the older we get, the smarter we get, and the more knowledge that we have. So surely it should reflect in the way that we're davening.
So I think that while no doubt the problem is an old one, but the opportunities and the advancements that we have really are what we should take advantage of. So today, you know, to have translated Sidurim, transliterated Sidurim, Peirush on Tefillah, while you Torah has unbelievable Shiurim on Torah, on Tefillah. So the opportunities that there are to continue to mature ourselves in davening is something that we have. And to take advantage of, and to constantly challenge ourselves. There was a confession by one of my congregants who told me that while she went to Yeshiva High School her whole life, she told me a number of weeks ago that she did something that she never did before. She davened the Musaf. And I was a little surprised. I see her in Shul most of Shabbos, and she's davening. She's usually there, and it seems that she's davening the Musaf. So I asked her what she meant. She said that she davened the Musaf in English, because her whole life she davened the Musaf, but she didn't know what she was saying. And she took an art twister and she looked on the other side of the page and she saw and she wrote the English translation. And I challenged her to, with all of her davening, to ultimately try to achieve the goal of davening in Hebrew, Lashon Kodesh, of course, but to be able to, in a vernacular that she's more comfortable, to have translation, to have explanation, to be able to understand and to connect to the words with the deep meaning, the download she learned, and to listen to her, to challenge herself and all of us to be able to take advantage of all of those
opportunities.
Why does it happen to me? To take advantage of all of those opportunities that we have before us. I guess I'll just share one final personal anecdotal story. That is, you know, taking differing age kids to a baseball game is a wondrous experience. And taking children to a Miami Marlins game is in and of itself a unique experience. So there are those kids, the older kids, when they go to a baseball game, they go for the very specific reason for which we came. They came to watch the game, the visiting team, the home team, they're interested in
their favorite player, how the pitcher's going to pitch, and the speed of the velocity of the fastball, who's going to hit a home run, the excitement, the jubilation, the joy, the celebration, v'chule, v'chule. And then they're the younger kids, that they can care less about the game. They're interested in the Cracker Jacks, interested in the Twizzlers, and the soda, they're interested in the kosher stand. They're literally interested in everything but the game. And it was on a last occasion, a most recent occasion in a baseball game, where I literally had to interfere. And I said, really, in a baseball game, there was tension between the two siblings, the older and the younger, where the older said, this sibling of mine, my brother, has no idea why we're in a game. It's not why you come to a ball game. You come to a ball game to watch the game. You don't come to a ball game to eat. But the reality is, when you're a youngster and when you're immature and you have a less than developed way of appreciating what the game is, so you come to do other things. And we're all smart enough, we're all inspired. Look how many are here on a Wednesday night to learn, spent the whole week learning about tefillah and the importance of how to bring new ideas to shape, to be more meaningful in our tefillah, to be more present. We're all looking to mature that, to be able to realize that we're actually in the game, to watch the game, but not just to be a spectator, but to be a participant. And to be uplifted and to make it so that every single time we take 3 steps back, we take 3 steps forward, because who we were is not who we are, and who we've become is not who we remain. It's who we become, and it's who we are, and it's who we live our lives inspired to become. And so with all of the resources and plethora of so many that there are, to really take advantage of them and to never limit our success by staying stagnant, by encouraging ourselves, by setting goals, and realizing the great treasure of the opportunity, and that's what it is, an opportunity to continually, to daily, thrice daily, and of course more, to commune with our Creator, to create, to speak to the Almighty, to ask for, to petition, to give thanks, and to make the most of that experience to better ourselves, and to better ourselves as a people.
Once again, thank you for the hospitality, and thank you to Yeshiva University. Rabbi Edelman mentioned the first tefillah he ever understood was the Baruch Sh'amar B'Hayo Olam. So I'll just mention, for many millennia, Jews said this without even knowing what it means. Hashem could speak and the world could come into being. How's it possible? And ours is the first generation, so really appreciate it. But it's speech recognition. You talk, and your car takes you to young Israel Tirfa. I don't know if that's the your car can take you to young Israel Tirfa. You speak, and then... So I have a 6-year-old son, a little boy, and I overheard him the other day asking Alexa, Alexa, are you friends with Siri? It's Yiddish and Nachas right there. Kabbalic question, no? That's Nachas. Alexa, are you friends with Siri? Makes sense. What a great one. Rabbi Yaakov Kamensky gave the following fantastic mashal. He said, imagine a little 3-year-old boy has his upshare, and the family gathers, and he dips his finger in the honey, he licks the olive bays, cut the hair, it's a whole beautiful party, incredible. And he gets a little pair of tzitzis, his first pair of tzitzis, and the tzitzis have a little train, it's a yellow tov, he puts on a little pair of tzitzis over his head, they fit him, it's beautiful. Imagine that kid is bar mitzvah, still wearing the same pair of tzitzis. And now the tzitzis, they come up to his pupik, and then he's a chassid, he's standing under the chuppah. And Yaakov says, imagine, he's wearing the same pair of tzitzis, they barely cover him, it's a yellow toe, a little picture, look. He's a zayde, he's still wearing the little pair of tzitzis, it's a yellow toe on them. Yaakov says, it's absurd, of course none of us would do that. We don't do that when it comes to tzitzis, but we do that with so much else of our Yiddishkeit. Our understanding of Parshas Bo is the same at 70 or 60 or 50 years old as it was at 13 or 10. Maybe we knew it better then because we had to bring home the Far Torah. Our understanding of the davening is the same at 40 or 80 years old as it was when we were 20. We're wearing the same pair of tzitzis that say yellow toe. We've grown, but our knowledge, our understanding hasn't. We don't do that in any other area of our life. We don't read the newspaper. I just got kishka for the chalfish out. We don't read the newspaper, whatever newspaper you read, you don't read it the same way at 7 years old as when you used to read it from the sports section when you were 10. Every other way we develop, we become more sophisticated, we grow, and when it comes to our yahadus, our yiddishka, when it comes to davening in particular, we're stuck. Wherever we last left off in school, the last class we had on davening, that's it. We're locked in, and we get stuck there. And we get stuck there. So, the Gemara tells us 4 things need chizuk, and one of them is davening. Again, it's not a new problem. It needs chizuk. It needs chizuk, and that's why it's so beautiful this week was devoted and what we're here to be able to accomplish together. So I want to suggest to you that the issue is not davening. We have hanging in our home, in a box frame, a tehillim that belonged to my wife's grandmother, her Bobby. Her Bobby's tehillim, I don't know how she got it. We're lucky to get it. Her siblings haven't noticed yet that we took it. So her Bobby had this tehillim, and the tehillim is worn out. Every page is soaked with tears. I knew her Bobby, I knew her very well, Allah Shalom, survivor, an incredibly special woman. I don't want to disparage her in the least, but given her education in Hungary and the interruption to her life at a young age of the war, I'm pretty confident she barely understood one word in the whole tehillim. If she had to be tested, the tehillim in front of her and say, translate a kapitel. Tehillim's not so easy to understand. Language is very difficult, the poetry is very difficult. I don't have any tehillim. I don't want to disparage her, astonishing you at all about that, English, Hebrew, Yiddish. But it's very hard to translate. And yet, despite her perhaps lack of translation or comprehension, she certainly couldn't quote to you the Mitzvahs, Dovin, the Ibn Ezra, the Radak, and the Malbin, and tell you every pirush on every kapitel tehillim. But every kapitel tehillim went right through her, went to her neshama. Every page absorbed her tears, her hopes, her dreams, her aspirations, her pain, her suffering, her disappointment. What's my point? To a degree, we need to do better at teaching davening. The davening, our children, forget our children, we, who have intellectual and cognitive capacity and the time on our hands, still don't understand the basic Perush HaMitzvah. We don't understand what the words mean, we don't understand what we're saying, we don't understand the themes. We need to work on that. I started VRS between Mincha Maariv, we do 6 minutes, we call 6 minute sitter snippets, we do something in the sitter 6 minutes every day. And I'm loving it. I don't know if anyone else is benefiting. I prepare, and I prepare hard for it. I look through all these different svarim. One bracha, yesterday I spoke 10 minutes, Bokeh Ivrim. Today we're up to Mab B'Shavun. We'll be done in 3 lifetimes with the sitter, at the pace we're going. We need to understand better what we're saying. There's no question, our davening needs work. But as much as our davening needs work, we need work in becoming daveners. Bobby was a davener, even if she didn't understand the davening. And we're graduating some students who understand davening. They got a 4.0, they aced the test, they memorized all the pirushim on every word, but they don't know how to be daveners. Ask them if they have emunah and bitachon, if they're experiencing tzedakus. Do they feel Hashem in their life? Do they lean on Him? Do they rely on Him? Do they love Him? Do they feel His love? Do they turn to Him? Are they grateful to Him? There's a world of difference between being the davening and becoming a davener. And I think one of the things that we need to work on as we grow and mature, as we outgrow our yellow toed tzitzis and put on some big boy tzitzis and we put on our mature, the metaphor applies equally across men and women, but as we continue to grow and become more sophisticated, it's not only learning how to do davening, but it's learning how to be daveners. I once read a great line by a motivational speaker, motivational guru, who said, don't live the same year many times and call it a life. Don't live the same year many times in a row and call it a life. If we want to live a life, it's not just our 10-year-old understanding and living it many years in a row. If we want to live a life, it's every year measuring our growth, both in our davening and as daveners. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Before we close the program, on behalf of Yeshiva University, we really want to thank all of you for an amazing week. We want to thank Rabbi Edelman and the incredible community for being such gracious hosts. We have a gift for each of our panelists who took time out of their very busy schedules to share with us all of this guidance and inspiration. It is a new sefer that was just published by one of our Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Daniel Feldman, called Binah B'Sfarim. It's on the topic of Kibud Av V'Em. So we share this with you, and we thank you so much for all of your hard work and your investment of time. And I turn the floor for our closing remarks.
What a wonderful way to end such a fantastic week. Ladies and gentlemen, what do you think of our twinning with Yeshiva?